put all the food. After a game, everyone tucks in. Another expression of class. The staff have their own quarters. So I never ceased to be concerned at the high quality Arsenal could bring to our tussles. History helped us, but it helped them too. And they had the right manager. Arsene was the right one because he always felt that, having been given the chance to manage in England, he put his tent down and was never going to move it. All the while, there was speculation that he might leave one day to join Real Madrid. I never thought Arsene would leave Arsenal. Ever. I'd say to myself, we're going to have to put up with it. He's going to be here forever. I'd better get used to it. At times it was very edgy. Although Arsene would never come in for a drink after games, Pat Rice, his assistant, would always cross the threshold for a glass until the pizza fight at Old Trafford. My recollection of that fabled incident is that when Ruud van Nistelrooy came into the dressing room, he complained that Wenger had been giving him stick as he left the pitch. Right away, I rushed out to say to Arsene, "You leave my players alone." He was incensed at losing the game. That was the reason for his combative behaviour. "You should attend to your own players," I told him. He was livid. His fists were clenched. I was in control. I knew it. Arsene had a thing about van Nistelrooy. I remember him saying he'd had a chance to sign Ruud, but had decided he was not good enough to play for Arsenal. I agreed with him in the sense that van Nistelrooy may not have been a great footballer, but he was a great goal scorer. Anyway, the next thing I knew, I had pizza all over me. We put food into the away dressing room after every game. Pizza, chicken, most clubs do it. Arsenal's food was the best. They say it was Cesc Fabregas who threw the pizza at me, but to this day, I have no idea who the culprit was. The corridor outside the dressing room turned into a rabble. Arsenal had been defending a 49-game unbeaten record and had been hoping to make it 50 on our turf. It seemed to me that losing the game scrambled Arsene's brain. That day created a division between us, without doubt, and that rift extended to Pat Rice, who stopped coming in for a drink after games. The wound was not fully healed until the Champions League semi-final in 2009, when Arsene invited us into his room after the game and congratulated us. When we played them at Old Trafford a few weeks later, Arsene came in with Pat, just for a few minutes. In football, you do see incidents that reflect normal conflicts in life. In our home lives, sometimes. You know when your wife turns that machine off and won't talk to you? "Christ, what have I done?" you think. "Have you had a good day?" you ask. "Yeah," she mumbles. Then the anger passes and normality returns. Football is like that. I would have hated the silence between Arsene and me to go on so long that it became poisonous. At my end of it, I had a formula for defeat. After saying my bit in the dressing room, always before going through that door to face the press, to face the television, to speak to the other manager, I said to myself, "Forget it. The game's gone." I always did that. Whenever people came to my room at the ground after a game, I always made sure there was a good atmosphere. There was no gloom, no frostiness, no blaming the referee. When Aston Villa beat us at Old Trafford in the 2009-2010 season, it was the first time they had beaten us on our turf in decades. Martin O'Neill, whose conversation I always enjoy, practically moved into my office with his wife and daughter. It felt like an hour and a half. It was a really good night. John Robertson, Martin's assistant, and a few of my friends joined us, and it turned into a real get-together. I ended up needing a driver to take me home. When we lost in the FA Cup third round to Leeds United, the Leeds physio, Alan Sutton, couldn't stop laughing and smiling in my office. As he left, I said, "You're still bloody laughing." "I can't help it," he said. It was the first time in my Old Trafford career that Leeds had beaten us on our soil, and he was just incapable of not grinning. His pleasure was infectious. You have to say to yourself, "I'm a human being. I must keep my dignity." I was hospitable in that way to all the managers who joined me after the game. I saw a change in Arsenal in the last few years. When the Invincibles were forming, we were in transition. Around 2002, we were rebuilding the side. The Arsenal side of 2001-2002 won the title at our ground, of course, and were accorded a standing ovation by our supporters. An attribute of Manchester United fans is that they will always acknowledge class. There were times when I would think bitterly, "Go on. Go and applaud them, why don't you? Meanwhile, I'll go into the dressing room and pick our players up." That is how they are. I remember their standing ovation for the Brazilian Ronaldo after his Champions League hat-trick against us. As he left the pitch, Ronaldo seemed bemused, like his manager. Strange club, this, they must have thought. Gary Lineker's last game in England for Spurs was also warmly received. But there is a lot to be said for it. It brings football to its zenith. If you see class, excitement, entertainment, there is an obligation to acknowledge it. Those people have seen all the best United teams, so they know what a good side is. They have the necessary reference points. They know what a top player is as well. On top of that, you have to acknowledge when you're beaten. There's nothing to be done. Sulking is futile. The Old Trafford game in 2002 was a non-event for me in one sense. Even if we were chasing second place, it was already obvious that Arsenal's team were going to win the league. There was a sense of destiny. In those moments of defeat and acceptance, there would be a dawning for me of where we needed to go. My feeling was always, I don't like this, but we'll have to meet the challenge. We'll have to step up a mark. It wouldn't have been me or the club to submit to apocalyptic thoughts about that being the end, the finish of all our work. We could never allow that. Every time those moments poked us in the eye, we accepted the invitation to regroup and advance again. Those were motivating passages. They forced me on. I'll go further. I can't be sure that without those provocations, I would have enjoyed the job so much. In later years, we learned more about Arsenal's thinking. Arsene had a template of how he sees his players and the way they play. We didn't need to win the ball against Arsenal. We needed to intercept it. You need good players who can intercept. We worked out that when the ball was played into Fabregas with his back to goal. He would turn it round the corner and meet the return pass. He would twist the pass round the corner, then run to get it back on the other side of the defender. So we would say to our players, stay with the runner, then intercept the pass. Then we counter-attacked quickly. They were more dangerous at Old Trafford than their own ground. Away from home, they didn't feel obliged to throw everything at us. They were more conservative. Barcelona were far more organised than Arsenal. When they lost the ball, they would hound it. Every one of their players would be after it to win it back. Arsenal didn't have quite that dedication to the task of regaining possession. Then again, sometimes Barcelona would imitate Arsenal in over-elaborating because they enjoyed it so much. Against Real Madrid at the Bernabeu in 2009, Messi was playing 1-2s in the Real Madrid penalty box. Not just one, but two or three, while the Madrid defenders were all over the place. They won 6-2, but for a time, I thought they would throw the game away. We all have to put our hands up to having players who were over-physical at times, but Arsene could never do that, which was a weakness. It's not a crime to admit guilt when a player is sent off. You should feel bad because he's let his team down. I had some issues with Paul Scholes. I even fined him for the silly things. I don't get upset when a player is booked when he was on for the tackle, but if he's sent off for a stupid challenge and Scholesy was guilty of that, he would be fined. But if you expect a player to go through a season without infringing the laws of the game, you're asking for miracles. Arsene's softer centre in my later years reflected the players he brought to the club. Samir Nasri becomes available, so Arsene takes him. Rositsky becomes available, so he takes him, because he's his type of player. Arshavin becomes available, so in he comes. When you acquire a lot of those players, they're almost clones. The team Arsene inherited gave him a start in English football. We stayed on these parallel tracks right to the end, and of course we were united by a desire to find and develop young players in our own image. Then again, Aaron Ramsey said before we played Arsenal one time that he had chosen Arsenal's team over mine because Arsenal produced more players than Man United. I thought, what world is he in? I think a young boy can get manipulated into saying things. It was his own decision to reject United, and I have no problem with that. I thought he made the wrong choice. I must say, though, he would have faced more competition at our place to make the first team. Arsenal had not produced many of their own players. They had developed players, which is not the same thing. They bought from clubs in France and all over the place. The only truly homegrown player I could think of was Jack Wilshere. Giggs, Neville, Scholes, Fletcher, O'Shea, Brown, Welbeck, all produced at Man United. There I go again. I could never be anything other than competitive with Arsene. My rival, for 17 years. 14. The Class of 92. Each time a member of our great homegrown generation left the club, I would count those left. Two managed to stay to the end of my time. Paul Scholes and Ryan Giggs. Gary Neville almost made it through with me. Even now I can visualise the six of them, taking the mickey out of each other as boys after training. Scholesy would try to hit the back of Nicky Butt's head with the ball, or Gary's head more often. He was a devil for that. Those half-dozen young men were inseparable. These were solid human beings, the sort you hated losing. They understood the club and its purpose. They would march with you, defend the principles on which we operated. Any parent would recognise that moment when a 21-year-old walks in and says they are going to buy their own place, or move in with a girlfriend, or take a job in some other town. They leave you. Football was the same for me. I became greatly attached to the men who were with me from their teenage years, the so-called class of 92. I saw them grow from 13 years of age. Nicky Butt was a prime example. He always reminded us of the cartoon character with the freckles, big ears and buck teeth on the front page of the comic Mad. That mischief, that devilment. They were so long under my care that they felt like family to me. I would chastise them more than other players because they felt like relatives more than employees. Nicky was always up to something, a jack the lad. He was also brave as a lion, incapable of shirking any challenge. He was one of the most popular players to have played at our club. He was a real Manchester lad, down to earth and mentally tough. Like Phil Neville, Nicky reached the point where he wasn't playing often enough to satisfy his competitive urges. That prompted him to look elsewhere for openings. Once again, we let him go very cheaply, for $2 million. Those men didn't owe us a penny. We had acquired them for nothing through our academy. The money for Nicky was a token sum to ensure he left for the best deal. Right to the end of his playing days, he would refer to us as his club. Behind my back, I'm sure those lads resented bearing the brunt of my annoyance. "Oh, me again," they probably thought. "Why don't you give him over there some?" The first person I would give stick to was Giggsy, bless him. As youngsters, they would never answer back. With time, Ryan learned to defend himself. Nicky might also retaliate now and then. Gary would have a go, but then Gary would answer his shadow back. He has to have an argument every day. He'd be up at 6 o'clock with the papers, texting Di Law or Karen Shotbolt, our press officers. "Have you read this in the Telegraph or the Times?" We always said of Gary that he woke up angry. His was an argumentative nature. He is a forthright guy. Where he sees error, sees flaws, he attacks them. His instinct was not to negotiate his way through an impasse, but strike hard with his opinions. There was no consensus with Gary. He was explosive. I would see a small issue escalate in his mind. But with me, he knew where the limits of my patience were. I would say, "Gary, go and annoy someone else." Then he would laugh, and the drama would be diffused. If I try to imagine those 20 years without the homegrown lads, I find it hard to visualise the base of the team. They provided our stability. Manchester United are recognised for the great players we found in the 26 years I was there. From Brian Robson and Norman Whiteside and Paul McGrath onwards, through to Cantona and Ronaldo. But those homegrown boys carried the spirit of Manchester United inside them. That's what they gave the club. Spirit. They were a great example to our coaching staff of what could be achieved through youth development and a beacon to the young players coming through. Their presence told the next 19-year-old coming up the line, "This can be done. The next Cantona can be created here at our academy, on our training ground." I will always remember Paul Scholes' first day at our club. He came in with a little guy called Paul O'Keefe. His father, Eamon, had played at Everton. They were standing behind Brian Kidd, who had told me he was bringing in two lads he liked the look of. They were 13. "Where are these two young kids?" I asked Brian. They were so small they were invisible behind Brian's frame. They were about 4 feet 8 inches tall. I looked at this tiny pair and thought, "How are these two going to become footballers?" It became a standing joke at the club. When Scholesy came into the youth team, I said in the coach's room, "That Scholes has got no chance, too small." When he joined us properly at 16, he was still minuscule. but he really did shoot up. By 18, he had risen 3 or 4 inches. Paul never said a word. He was exceptionally shy. His father had been a good player, and they had shared a nickname, Archie. When I harboured those initial doubts about his size, I had never seen him play in a game, though I had looked at him in training at the School of Excellence. At the indoor centre, we mainly taught technical skills. When he progressed to play for the A youth team, he was a centre-forward. "He's not got the pace to play centre-forward," I said. They played him just behind a striker. In one of the early games at the Cliff, he hit one in the drop just outside the box, and it stopped my breath with its power. "He's good, but I don't think there's any chance of making it. Too small," said Jim Ryan, who was watching with me. It became a stock phrase at the club. "Scholesy, too small." As his time with us rolled on, Paul Scholes encountered problems with his asthma. He didn't play in the youth team the year they won the FA Youth Cup. Beckham joined the team only in the later rounds because he had grown gangly and weak. Simon Davis, who played for Wales, was the captain. Robbie Savage was also in the side. The majority of them went on to be internationals. Another, Ben Thornley, would have earned a cap, but for major knee trouble. As a young forward in the hole, Scholes would be guaranteed 15 goals a season. When he developed into a central midfield player, he had the brain for the passing game and a talent for orchestration. He must have been a natural. I loved watching teams trying to mark him out of the game. He would take them into positions they didn't want to go to, and with a single touch, he would turn the ball round the corner or feint away and hit the reverse pass. Opponents would spend a minute tracking him, and then be made to appear inconsequential and sometimes even foolish. They would end up galloping back to their own box. He would destroy a marker that way. Paul endured several disappointments with long-term injuries, but would always come back better. He was a superior player after his eye problem and after his knee injury. He would return re-energised. In his early 30s, he was prone to occasional bouts of frustration as the competition for midfield places intensified. I had Darren Fletcher and Michael Carrick to consider in the two central positions. I confess, I made an error here. Taking people for granted is not a mistake you are necessarily aware of at the time, and it is hard to correct until you're confronted by the effect on the victim. My attitude was that, in times of need, I could always go back to Scholesy. He was a loyal servant, always ready and willing to step in. Carrick and Fletcher would be my new first-choice pairing, and Scholes would be the ageing support. It was in my mind for too long that Paul was coming to the end of his career. In the 2009 Champions League final in Rome, which we lost to Barcelona, I sent Paul on in the second half. Anderson had made only 3 passes in the first half. Scholes made 25 in the last 20 minutes of the game. You think you know everything in this game? You don't. Taking people for granted and thinking you can always go back to them as they approach the end is wrong. You forget how good they are. At the end, consequently, I used him a lot more and rested him at the right times. People would ask me to pick my best Man United team. I would find it incredibly difficult. You couldn't leave out Scholes, and you couldn't leave out Brian Robson. They would both give you at least 10 goals a season. But then, that raises the question, how can you leave out Keane? You would have to play the three of them. But if you do that, who do you play with Cantona, who was always better playing with another forward? Try picking one striker from McClare, Hughes, Solskjaer, Van Nistelrooy, Sheringham, York, Cole, Rooney and Van Persie. You couldn't disregard Giggs. So it always felt like an impossible task to select a best 11. Yet you would have to say Cantona, Giggs, Scholes, Robson and Cristiano Ronaldo could never be left out of a Man United side. Scholes was probably the best English midfielder since Bobby Charlton. Since I have been in England, Paul Gascoigne was the best of those who could lift you from your seat. In his last few years, Paul Scholes elevated himself above Gascoigne, one for longevity and two for improving himself in his 30s. He was such a brilliant long passer that he could choose a hair in the head of any teammate answering the call of nature at our training ground. Gary Neville once thought he had found refuge in a bush, but Scholes he found him from 40 yards. He inflicted a similar long-range missile strike once on Peter Schmeichel and was chased round the training ground for his impertinence. Scholesy would have made a first-class sniper. As a player myself, I never possessed the innate ability of a Cantona or a Paul Scholes. Eyes in the back of the head. but I could see it in others because I watched so many games. I knew how important those players were to a team. Scholes, Cantona, Veron. Beckham had good vision too. He was not the sort who could thread great passes through, but he could see the other side of the pitch all right. Laurent Blanc had good vision. Teddy Sheringham and Dwight York could see what was happening all around them. But of the players in the top echelon, Scholes was the best of that type. When we were winning easily, Scholes would sometimes try something daft, and I would say, "Look, he's getting bored now." Ryan Giggs was the biggest noise from that generation. He was one of the most likely to be identified as a wonder boy. Awarding him a first-team debut at 17 landed us with a problem we had not expected. The Giggs phenomenon. An Italian agent phoned me when Ryan was a kid and asked,
"What do your sons do?"
I said, "Mark's doing a degree. Jason's going into television. Darren's an apprentice here." He said,
"Sell me Giggs and I can make them rich."
Naturally, I declined the offer. The George Best comparison stuck to him immediately and was impossible to dislodge. Everyone wanted a piece of him. But Giggs was smart. "See the manager," he would say, to anyone seeking an interview or a tie-up. He didn't want to grant interviews and found a way to transfer the blame for the refusal onto me. He was clever. Brian Robson approached Ryan one day to recommend Harry Swales as an agent. He had checked it with me first. Brian was coming to the end and was sure Harry was the right man for Giggs. He was right. Harry is fantastic. Got engaged at 81 to a Swiss lady he met on the platform of a railway station. She was lost. He is a former sergeant major with a handlebar moustache. He looked after Ryan really well. Ryan has a strong mother too, and his grandparents were very, very good people. To stretch his first-team career to 2 decades, Ryan had to develop a meticulous fitness programme. Yoga and his preparation routines were at the root of his longevity. Ryan was religious about yoga. Twice a week after training, an expert would come in to guide him through the exercises. That became vital to him. In the days when he was susceptible to hamstring injuries, we were never sure how much we could play him. His hamstrings were a constant concern. We would leave him out of games to have him ready for others. By the end, only his age would prompt us to give him a rest. He would play 35 games a season because his fitness was fantastic. Ryan's intelligence helped him make the sacrifices in his social life. He is a reserved kind of guy, but of all that bunch, he was the one they looked up to. He was the king, the man. There was a brief period when he and Paul Ince would wear daft suits, but it soon passed. Ryan still has the suit that caused me to blurt, "Who the hell is that?" Ince was a fan of flash dressing, and he and Giggs were good pals. They were a duo. But Ryan has led a highly professional life. He is revered around the club, where everyone defers and looks up to him. When his pace deteriorated, we played him more in the centre of the park. We no longer expected him to flash round the outside of defenders the way he did as a boy. Not many people noticed that, even in his later incarnation, he retained his change of pace, which is sometimes more important than raw speed. His balance, too, was unaffected. In the autumn of 2010, he was brought down by West Ham's Jonathan Spector in the penalty box, and I seized my chance to set a quiz question. How many penalties had Ryan Giggs won in his Manchester United career? Answer? 5. Because he always stays on his feet. He stumbles, but never goes down. I would ask him, after a heavy foul in the box, why he had declined to go down, which he would have been entitled to do, and he would look at me as if I had horns. He would wear that vacant look. "I don't go down," he would say. Ryan is a calm boy, very even-tempered in adversity. Strange to say, he was never a great substitute until his later years. He was always better starting a game, but he played a great role as a sub in the 2008 Champions League final in Moscow and against Wigan when we won the league, coming on to score our second goal. He removed the doubt we had about him being a good impact player and was an amazing asset to have off the bench. Giggs turned his back on the fame and the branding. He lacked the temperament for that level of exposure. His personality was more introverted. To lead that life, you need great energy to be trotting all over the world and putting your face in front of a camera. It also requires a certain vanity, the belief that this is what you were made for. You read about actors always knowing they wanted to be on the stage or in films. I never had that magnetic attraction to fame. My hope was that players who had grown up with us would carry things on at Carrington and maintain the continuity, much as Uli Hoeneß and Karl-Heinz Rummenigge, say, had at Bayern Munich. They understand how the club functions and the standard of player needed to keep the show rolling along. Whether that leads in the end to management cannot be known, because it depends on how the coaching side develops. But Giggs and Scholes are both intelligent men who understand United's soul and were great players themselves. So all the right stuff was there. Ryan could definitely be a manager because he's so wise and players invariably respect him. His relative quietness would not be a barrier. There are plenty of non-vocal managers. But your character must be strong. To deal with a club like Manchester United, your personality has to be bigger than those of the players. Or you have to believe it is, to control the whole picture. You have big players, wealthy players, world-famous players, and you have to rule over them, stay on top of them. There is only one boss of Manchester United, and that's the manager. Ryan would need to cultivate that side of himself, but so did I, from 32 years of age. At school we would be asked, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" I would say, "A footballer." Fireman was a more popular answer. To say footballer implied no urge to be known across the world, merely to earn a living by playing the game. Giggs would have been that type. You can be destined by your nature to chase a certain ending. And David Beckham always had that air of knowing where he was going. He was comfortable with that lifestyle and keen to attain that status. None of the others would have even dreamed about worldwide recognition. It was not part of them. Imagine Gary Neville with fashion photographers. "Can you bloody hurry up?" They were all lucky to have the protection of really good families. The Nevilles are really solid people. The same was true for all of them. It was a blessing for them and for us. They know the value of a good upbringing, keeping your feet on the ground, manners, respect for older generations. If I had called someone from an older generation by their first name, my dad would have clipped me in the ear. "Mister, to you," he would have said. All that has disappeared now. All my players would call me Gaffer or Boss. Lee Sharp came in one day and asked, "How you doing, Alex?" I said, "Were you at school with me?" Even better, a young Irish boy, Paddy Lee, saw me moving up the stairs of the cliff as I was coming down with Brian Robson behind me and said, "You all right, Alex?" I said, "Were you at school with me?" "No," he said, perturbed. "Well, don't call me Alex." I get the giggles now, recalling these moments. Behind the fierce response, I'd be laughing inside. Wee Paddy Lee was terrific at animal impressions. Every Christmas, he would do ducks, cows, birds, lions, tigers, everything. Even ostriches. The players would be rolling about. Paddy went to Middlesbrough for a year, but didn't quite make it. Wee George Switzer was another. Typical Salford boy. In the training ground canteen, he was brilliant at barking things out and disguising where it had come from. So the victim would scan the room, trying to spot the perpetrator. "My boss!" Or, "Archie!" to Archie Knox. For a long time, it was impossible to nail the culprit. There were no clues in the sea of faces at mealtimes. But one day, I caught him. "All right, son," I said. "You do that again and you'll run round the pitch till you're dizzy." "Sorry, boss," Sweat stuttered. Despite the image of me as someone who wanted obedience at all times, I loved people with a bit of devil in them. It was refreshing. You need self-confidence, a bit of nerve. If you're surrounded by people who are scared to express themselves in life, they will be equally frightened when it really matters, on the pitch, in games. Those lads from the 1992 class were never scared of anything. They were mighty allies. 15. Liverpool, a great tradition. From adversity, the really industrious clubs returned to their cycle of winning. Maybe I was lucky to have joined United in a troubled phase of their history. The league title had not been won for 19 years, and I inherited a culture of low expectation. We had become a cup team, and the fans anticipated a good run in the knockout competitions more than in league action, where their hopes were kept in check. My predecessors, Dave Sexton, Tommy Docherty, and Ron Atkinson, were successful men, but in their years there was no consistent or sustained challenge for the championship. The same was true of Liverpool in the years when United were on top from 1993 onwards. But I could always feel their breath in my neck from 25 miles away. When a club of Liverpool's history and tradition pull off a treble of cup wins, as they did in 2001, with the FA, League and UEFA trophies under Gerard Houllier, you're bound to feel a tremor of dread. My thought that year was, oh no, not them. Anybody but them. With their background, their heritage and their fanatical support, as well as their terrific home record, Liverpool were implacable opponents, even in their fallow years. I liked and respected Gerard Houllier, the Frenchman who took sole charge when the joint manager experiment with Roy Evans was ended by the Anfield board. Steven Gerrard was starting to emerge as a youthful force in midfield, and they could summon two sensational goal scorers in Michael Owen and Robbie Fowler. The big cultural change was investing power in someone from outside the Liverpool religion. The succession of internal appointments from Shanks to Bob Paisley to Joe Fagan to Kenny Dalglish to Graeme Souness to Roy Evans maintained consistency of purpose. Towards the end of Kenny's first spell in charge, you could sense a shift. The team had grown old and Liverpool were starting to make unusual purchases. Jimmy Carter, David Speedy, these were untypical Liverpool signings. Graeme Souness made the right move, but too quickly, breaking up an ageing team too fast. One mistake was to discard one of the best young players, Steve Staunton. Graeme would admit that himself. There was no need to let Staunton go. Graeme is a good guy, but he's impetuous. He can't get there quickly enough, and his impetuosity cost him in that period. A virtue of dealing with Liverpool back then was that they would all come into my office mob-handed after the game. I inherited the tradition of every member of our staff going in to see them at Anfield, and each one on their side reciprocating at Old Trafford. The Liverpool bootroom men had far more experience in that regard than me, but I learned quickly. Win, lose or draw, there would be a full turnout and a rapport between the two managerial clans. Because there was such a divide between the two cities and such competitive tension in the field, it was even more important to retain our dignity, whatever the result. It was vital, too, that we concealed our weak points, and Liverpool were equally guarded in that respect. Gerrard had been a visiting trainee teacher in Liverpool during his course at Lille University, and had examined the club with an academic's eye. He was not entering Anfield blind to its traditions. He understood the ethos, the expectations. He was a clever man, affable too. After he was rushed to hospital, following a serious heart attack, I said to him, "Why don't you just step upstairs?" "I can't do that," Gerrard replied. "I like working." He was a football man. Heart trouble could not break his addiction. Expectation always bears down on Liverpool managers, and I think that brand of pressure pierced Kenny's defences in the end. At the time he abandoned the role of iconic player and moved into the dugout, he possessed no managerial background. The same disparity undermined John Gregg at Rangers. Possibly the greatest Rangers player of all time, John inherited a disintegrating team that could not be restored to an even keel. The emergence of Aberdeen and Dundee United was no help. Playing in the glamour role up front as one of Liverpool's finest players, and then graduating to manager almost the next day, was very difficult for Kenny. I remember him coming to see me in the Scotland camp and asking for advice about a job he had been offered in management. It was only later I realised he'd been talking about the big one. "Is it a good club?" I had asked him. "Aye, it's a good club," he said. So I told him, if it was a good club, with good history, some financial leeway and a chairman who understands the game, he would have a chance. If only two of those variables could be ticked off, he was in for a battle. Without my intensive education at Aberdeen, I would have been poorly qualified to take over at Manchester United. I started at East Stirling without a penny. I enjoyed that, with 11 or 12 players. Then I went to St Mirren without a dime. I freed 17 players in my first season. They weren't good enough. They had 35 before I started swinging my machete. There, I would order the pies and the cleaning materials and the programmes. It was a full education. When Gerrard started importing large numbers of foreign players, I thought the treble-winning season offered proof that the policy might restore the club to its pomp. The likes of Vladimir Smitsa, Sami Hupia, and Dietmar Hamann had established a strong platform on which Houllier could build. Any cup treble has to be taken seriously, You might say fortune smiled on them in the FA Cup final against Arsenal, because Arsene Wenger's team battered them in that match before Michael Owen won it with the second of his two goals. It wasn't the individuals that worried me around that time, so much as the name. Liverpool. The history. I knew that if this upsurge continued, they would become our biggest rivals again, ahead of Arsenal and Chelsea. A year after that cup treble, they finished runners-up, but then fell away to fifth after Gerrard brought in Elhadj Diouf, Salif Diaw and Bruno Cheroux, from which many commentators drew a line of cause and effect. Cheroux was one we looked at when he was at Lille. He had no pace, but a nice left foot. A strong lad, but not quick. Diouf had a good World Cup with Senegal, and made a name for himself. You could understand Gerrard's antennae twitching. I was always wary of buying players on the back of good tournament performances. I did it at the 1996 European Championship, which prompted me to move for Jordi Cruyff and Karel Poborski. Both had excellent runs in that tournament, but I didn't receive the kind of value their countries did that summer. They weren't bad guys, but sometimes players get themselves motivated and prepared for World Cups and European Championships, and after that, there could be a levelling off. With Diouf, there was a talent, but it needed nurturing. He was a persistent thorn in your flesh, and not always in a nice way. He'd be silly on the pitch, but he had a right competitive edge about him, and he had ability. Joining an august club like Liverpool was not compatible with his rebellious side, because he found it hard to conform to the discipline you need to be successful. Gerrard soon found that out. With the number of high-intensity games you are going to play against Arsenal and Chelsea, you need players of a good temperament. And, in my opinion, Diouf had a dodgy one. Cheroux just never made it. He didn't have the pace to play in the Premier League. The Spice Boy culture was another dragon Gerrard had to slay. I would hear stories of Liverpool players nipping across to Dublin for recreation. I felt that Stan Collymore's arrival was hardly conducive to stability. I nearly bought Collymore myself because there was an incredible talent. But when I watched him play for Liverpool, there was no great urgency about him, and I began to think what a lucky guy I had been for not buying him. I can only assume he would have been the same at United. Instead, I took Andy Cole, who was always brave as a lion and always gave his best. Before the upswing under Houllier, Liverpool had fallen into the trap that had caught United years before. They would buy players to fit a jigsaw. If you look at Man United from the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s, they were buying players such as Gary Birtles, Arthur Graham from Leeds United, Peter Davenport, Terry Gibson, Alan Brazil. There seemed to be a desperation. If someone scored against United, they would be signed. It was that kind of short-term thinking. Liverpool acquired the same habit. Ronnie Rosenthal, David Speedy, Jimmy Carter. A succession of players arrived who weren't readily identifiable as Liverpool players. Collymore, Phil Babb, Neil Ruddock, Mark Wright, Julian Dix. Gerrard brought a wide mix of players to Anfield. Milan Baroš, Luis Garcia, Schmitzer and Hamann, who did a fine job for him. I could see a pattern emerging in Gerrard's recruiting. Under Benitez, I could observe no such strategy. Players came and went. There was a time when I looked at his first 11 and felt they were the most unimaginative Liverpool side I ever went up against. In one game against us, he played Javier Mascherano in central midfield and had his back four, as usual, but played Steven Gerrard wide left, with Alberto Aquilani off the front. He took Dirk Kuyt off and put Ryan Babel on the left, moving Gerrard to the right. The three played in a pack through the middle. Babel was on as an outside left, but not once did he work the touchline. I can't know what his orders were, but on the bench, I remember saying it was a good time to bring him on, wide left against Gary Neville. I told Scholes, warn Gary to concentrate, but Liverpool played with hardly any width at all. Apparently Benitez came to our training ground as a guest of Steve McLaren, but I don't remember meeting him. We received lots of visits from overseas coaches, and it was hard to keep track of them all. We had people from China and Malta, and groups of three and four from Scandinavian countries. There was also a steady flow of other sportsmen. The Australia cricket team, NBA players, Michael Johnson, Usain Bolt. Johnson, who runs a spring training program in Texas, impressed me with his knowledge. Soon after Benitez arrived, I attended a Liverpool game, and he and his wife invited me in for a drink. So far, so good. But our relationship frayed. The mistake he made was to turn our rivalry personal. Once you made it personal, you had no chance. Because I could wait. I had success on my side. Benitez was striving for trophies while also taking me on. That was unwise. On the day he produced his famous list of facts detailing my influence over referees, we received a tip-off that Liverpool would stage manage a question that would enable Benitez to go on the attack. That's not unusual in football. I had been known to plant a question myself. Put it this way. Our press office had warned me. We think Benitez is going to have a go at you today. What about? I don't know, but we've been tipped off, they said. So, on television, Benitez puts his glasses on and produces this sheet of paper. Facts. The facts were all wrong. First, he said I intimidate referees. The FA were scared of me, according to Rafa, even though I had just been fined £10,000 by the FA 2 weeks previously, and I was failing to support the Respect campaign. The Respect initiative had started that season, yet Rafa was going on about my criticism of Martin Atkinson in a cup tie the previous year, before the new guidelines had come into place. So he was wrong in the first two things he said. The media loved it, even though the facts were inaccurate. They were hoping it would start a war, that I would launch a rocket back. In fact, all I said in reply was that Rafa was obviously bitter about something, and I was at a loss to explain what that might be. That was me saying to him, "Look, you're a silly man. You should never make it personal." That was the first time he tried those tactics, and each subsequent attack bore the same personal edge. My inquiries told me that he had been irritated by me questioning whether Liverpool would be able to handle the title run-in, whether they would buckle under the pressure. Had I been the Liverpool manager, I would have taken that as a compliment. Instead, Benitez interpreted it as an insult. If I, as Manchester United manager, was talking about Liverpool and dropping in remarks to make them wobble, my Anfield counterpart ought to know they'd got me worried. When Kenny was in charge at Blackburn, and they were out in front in the title race, I piped up, "Well, we're hoping for a Devon Loch now." That stuck. Devon Loch popped up in every newspaper article, and Blackburn started to drop points. We ought to have won the league that year, but Rovers held on. There is no doubt we made it harder for them by raising the spectre of the Queen Mother's horse performing the splits on the Aintree run-in. The advance publicity had been that Benitez was a control freak, which turned out to be correct, to a point that made no sense. He displayed no interest in forming friendships with other managers, a dangerous policy, because there would have been plenty from lesser clubs who would have loved to share a drink and learn from him. In the 2009-2010 season, he did come in for a glass at Anfield, but he looked uncomfortable and, after a short while, said he needed to go, and that was that. To Sammy Lee, his assistant, I said, "At least that's a start." On the day, Roberto Martinez, manager of Wigan Athletic, was quoted as saying I had friends who did my bidding in relation to Benitez. Big Sam Allardyce was one he was referring to. Roberto phoned me and put a call into the LMA to ask whether he should make a statement correcting the story. Roberto told me he had no connection with Benitez, who had not helped him in any way. I think Martinez had spoken to a Spanish paper about the way Benitez saw us, his rivals in England, but was not endorsing that view himself. He was merely the messenger. You would think Benitez and Martinez would have struck up an affinity, being the only Spanish managers in England. Benitez would complain about having no money to spend, but from the day he landed, he doled out more than me. Far more. It amazed me that he used to walk into press conferences and say he had no money to spend. He was given plenty. It was the quality of his buys that let him down. If you set aside Torres and Reina, few of his acquisitions were of true Liverpool standard. There were serviceable players, Mascherano and Kuyt, hard-working players, but not really Liverpool quality. There was no Souness or Dalglish or Ronnie Whelan or Jimmy Case. Benitez did score two great successes in the transfer market, Pepe Reina, the goalkeeper, and Fernando Torres, their striker. Torres was a very, very talented individual. We watched him many times and tried to sign him when he was 16. We expressed our interest 2 years before he joined Liverpool, but we always felt that our contact with him would end only in him receiving an improved contract at Atletico Madrid. We watched him in many youth tournaments and always fancied him. He was ingrained in the fabric at Atletico, so I was surprised Liverpool were able to prize him away. Benitez's Spanish connections must have helped. Torres was blessed with great cunning, a shrewdness that was borderline Machiavellian. He had a touch of evil, though not in a physical sense, and he had that total change of pace. In a 45-yard sprint, he was no faster than several Liverpool players, but he had that change of pace which can be lethal. His stride was deceptively long. Without warning, he would accelerate and slice across you. Conversely, I'm not sure he was at his best when things were going against him, because his reactions could become petty. Perhaps he was spoilt at Atletico Madrid, where he was the golden boy for so long. He was captain there at 21. He had a fine physique, a striker's height and frame, and he was Liverpool's best centre-forward since Owen or Fowler. Another star, of course, was Steven Gerrard, who didn't always play well against Man United, but was capable of winning matches by himself. We made a show for him in the transfer market, as did Chelsea, because the vibe was that he wanted to move from Anfield, but there seemed to be some restraining influence from people outside the club, and it reached a dead end. His move to Chelsea seemed all set up. A question kept nagging at me. Why did Benitez not trust Gerrard as a central midfield player? The one thing we could be sure of in my later years against Liverpool was that if their two central midfielders won it off you, they would not do much with it. If Gerrard was in there and he won it against you, you knew he had the legs and the ambition to go right forward and hurt you. I could never understand why Liverpool so often neglected to play him centre mid. In 2008-2009, when they finished second with 86 points, they had Alonso to make the passes and Gerrard further up the pitch behind Torres. Another of our advantages was that they stopped producing homegrown talents. Michael Owen was probably the last. If Michael had joined us at 12 years old, he would have been one of the great strikers. In the year he played in the Malaysian youth finals, we had Ronnie Walwork and John Curtis there on England duty. When they returned, I gave them a month off, sent them on holiday. Michael Owen went straight into the Liverpool first team with no rest and no technical development. Michael improved as a footballer in the 2 years he had with us. He was terrific in the dressing room and was a nice boy. I think that lack of rest and technical development in his early years counted against him. By the time Julier inherited him, he was already formed and was the icon of the team. There was no opportunity by then to take him aside and work on him from a technical point of view. I made a mistake with Michael in the sense that I should have signed him earlier. There would have been no chance of him coming straight to Man United from Liverpool, but we should have stepped in when he left Real Madrid for Newcastle. He's a fine young man. Of the other Liverpool players who gave us trouble, Dirk Kuyt was as honest a player as you could meet. I'm sure he was 6'2" when he arrived and ended up 5'8" because he ran his legs into stumps. I've never known a forward player work so hard at defending. Benitez picked him every game, but then, if something happens in the opposition penalty box, will he be sharp enough, or is he exhausted from all the scuffling? Despite my reservations about him as a person and a manager, Benitez persuaded his players to work their socks off for him. So there must be some inspirational quality there. Fear, or respect, or skill on his part. You never saw his teams throw in the towel, and he deserves credit for that. Why did he not do as well as he might have at Anfield, from my perspective? Benitez had more regard for defending and destroying a game than winning it. You can't be totally successful these days with that approach. Jose Mourinho was far more astute in his handling of players. And he has personality. If you saw Jose and Rafa standing together on the touchline, you knew you could pick the winner. You always had to respect the Liverpool side. The same goes for some of the work Benitez put in, because they were a very hard side to beat, and because he won a European Cup there. There were plus points. He got lucky. But so did I, sometimes. His mode on the touchline was to constantly move his players around the pitch, but I doubt whether they were always watching him or acting on those instructions. No one could have understood all those gesticulations. On the other hand, with Mourinho, In a Chelsea-Inter match, I noticed the players sprinted over to him as if to say, "What, boss?" They were attentive to his wishes. You need a strong manager. That's vital. And Benitez is strong. He has a great faith in himself, and he is sufficiently stubborn to ignore his critics. He does that time and again. But he did win a European Cup against AC Milan in Istanbul in 2005, which offered him some protection against those who dismissed his methods. When Milan led 3-0 at half-time in that game, so the story goes, some of the Milan players were already celebrating, pulling on commemorative T-shirts and jigging about. I was told Paolo Maldini and Gennaro Rino Gattuso were going crackers, urging their teammates not to presume the game was over. Liverpool won the cup that night with a marvellous show of defiance. After a brief spell in charge at Anfield, Roy Hodgson gave way to Kenny again, and Liverpool embarked on another phase of major rebuilding. Yet few of the signings made in Kenny's time haunted me at night. We looked at Jordan Henderson a lot, and Steve Bruce was unfailingly enthusiastic about him. Against that, we noticed that Henderson runs from his knees with a straight back, while the modern footballer runs from his hips. We thought his gait might cause him problems later in his career. Stuart Downing cost Liverpool £20 million. He had a talent, but he was not the bravest or the quickest. He was a good crosser and a striker of the ball, but £20 million. Andy Carroll, who also joined for £35 million, was in our North East School of Excellence, along with Downing and James Morrison, who went on to play for Middlesbrough, West Brom and Scotland. The FA closed it down after complaints from Sunderland and Newcastle. This was at the time Academy started. The Carroll signing was a reaction to the Torres windfall of £50 million. Andy's problem was his mobility, his speed across the ground. Unless the ball is going to be in the box the whole time, it's very difficult to play the way Andy Carroll does, because defenders push out so well these days. You look for movement in the modern striker. Suarez was not quick in his feet, but has a fast brain. The boys Kenny brought in from the youth set-up did well. Jay Spearing especially was terrific. As a boy, Spearing was a centre-back, with John Flanagan at full-back, and Spearing was easily the best of them. Feisty, quick, a leader. You could see he had something. He was all right in the centre of midfield, but it was hard to visualise his long-term future. His physique, perhaps, counted against him. Kenny won the League Cup, of course, and reached the final of the FA Cup. But when I heard he and his assistant Steve Clark had been summoned to Boston to meet the club's owners, I feared the worst for them. I don't think the protest T-shirts and defending Suarez in the Patrice Evra saga helped Kenny. As a manager, your head can go in the sand a bit, especially with a great player. If it had been a reserve player rather than Suarez, would Kenny have gone to such lengths to defend him? The New York Times and Boston Globe editorials about the subsequent Evra Suarez non-handshake showed the way the debate was going. Kenny's problem, I feel, was that too many young people in the club idolised him. Peter Robinson, the club's chief executive in the glory years, would have stopped the situation escalating to the degree it did. The club has to take precedence over any individual. The next man in, Brendan Rodgers, was only 39. I was surprised they gave it to such a young coach. A mistake I felt John Henry made in Brendan's first weeks in charge in June 2012 was to sanction a fly-in-the-wall documentary designed to reveal the intimacies of life at Liverpool. To put that spotlight on such a young guy was hard, and it came across badly. It made no great impact in America, so I could not work out what the point of it was. My understanding is that the players were told they were obliged to give the interviews we saw on our screens. Brendan certainly gave youth a chance, which was admirable, and he achieved a reasonable response from his squad. I think he knew there had been some substandard buys. Henderson and Downing were among those who would need to prove their credentials. In general, you have to give players you might not rate a chance. Our rivalry with Liverpool was so intense, always. Underpinning the animosity, though, was mutual respect. I was proud of my club the day we marked the publication of the Hillsborough Report in 2012. A momentous week for Liverpool and those who had fought for justice. Whatever Liverpool asked for in terms of commemoration, we agreed to, and our hosts made plain their appreciation for our efforts. I told my players that day, no provocative goal celebrations, and if you foul a Liverpool player, pick him up. Mark Halsey, the referee, struck the right note with his marshalling of the game. Before the kick-off, Bobby Charlton emerged with a wreath which he presented to Ian Rush, who laid it at the Hillsborough Memorial by the Shankly Gates. The wreath was composed of 96 roses, one for each Liverpool supporter who died at Hillsborough. Originally, Liverpool wanted me and Ian Rush to perform that ceremony, but I thought Bobby was a more appropriate choice. The day went well, despite some minor slanging at the end by a tiny minority. For Liverpool to return to the level of us and Manchester City was clearly going to require huge investment. The stadium was another inhibiting factor. The club's American owners elected to refurbish Fenway Park, home of the Boston Red Sox, rather than build a new arena. To construct a major stadium these days is perhaps a £700 million enterprise. Anfield has not moved on. Even the dressing rooms are the same as 20 years ago. At the same time, my reading of their squad was that they needed 8 players to come up to title-winning standard. And if you have made mistakes in the transfer market, you often end up giving those players away for very little. While Brendan Rodgers went about his work, Rafa Benitez and I had not seen the last of one another. He returned to English football as Chelsea's interim manager when Roberto Di Matteo, who had won the Champions League in May, was sacked in the autumn of 2012. In a United press conference soon after Benitez's unveiling, I made the point that he was fortunate to inherit ready-made sides. I felt his record needed placing in context. He won the Spanish League with 51 goals in 2001-2002, which suggested he was a skilled pragmatist. But I found Liverpool hard to watch when he was manager there. I found them dull. It was a surprise to me that Chelsea called him. When Benitez placed his record alongside Di Matteo's, it would have been 2 league titles with Valencia, a European Cup and an FA Cup with Liverpool. In 6 months, Di Matteo had won the FA Cup and the European Cup. They were comparable records, yet Rafa had landed on his feet again. 16. A world of talent. From the moment Manchester United became a PLC in 1991, I was certain the club would be bought and taken into private ownership. Rupert Murdoch's B Sky B were the largest of the private bidders before Malcolm Glazer first took a stake in 2003. With our history and our aura, we were too big a prize to be ignored by individual investors. The only surprise to me when the Glazer family moved in to take control was that there had not been a host of wealthy suitors. Once the Glazers had seized their opportunity, Andy Walsh of the United Supporters Group called me to say,
"You have to resign."
Andy's a nice lad, but there was no temptation for me to agree to that request. I was a manager, not a director. Nor was I one of the shareholders who had sold the club. The takeover was not down to me in any way.
"We'll all be behind you,"
Andy said. My reply was, "But what do you think would happen to all my staff?" The moment I left, most of my assistants would have been out as well. Some had been with me for 20 years. The impact made on others when a manager changes his position is sometimes lost on those outside the circle. It was a worrying time, I admit. One of my concerns was how much money we might have to invest in the team. But I had to be confident both in my own ability to spot good players and the structure of the organisation. The Glazers were buying a good, solid club, and they understood that from the start. My first contact was a phone call from the father, Malcolm. 2 weeks later, his sons, Joel and Avi, came over to set out their position. They told me there would be no changes to the way the football side was run. In their view, the club was in good hands. I was a successful manager. They had no concerns. They were totally behind me. All the things I wanted to hear from them, I heard that day. I know there is always an element of window dressing. People tell you everything's fine, then make a million alterations. People lose their jobs. There are cutbacks because debts need to be repaid. But United stayed solid under the new ownership, irrespective of the borrowings people talked about and the interest payments incurred. Over the years, several supporter groups challenged me to define my stance in relation to the club's debts, and my answer was always, "I'm the manager. I'm working for a club owned by people in America." That was my standpoint. I never thought it sensible to upset the management side of the club by adding to the debate on models of ownership. If the Glazers had taken a more confrontational path, then it might have been different. If, for example, they had instructed me to get rid of one of my coaches. Any changes that might have undermined my ability to run the club would have altered the whole dynamic. But there was never that kind of pressure. So do you throw down your tools because some support